Menards is your electrical headquarters. We carry all the tools and testers you need for any electrical job. Stack up your toolbox with Southwire electrical products today. Right now, save big money on Southwire electrical tools, testers, cable ties, wire, and cable. Shop our huge selection in store at Menards. Ranked number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save big money at
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly.
I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But they love eating people. They love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic. There'd be a lot of poop in my pants.
Seeing a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Welcome back to Cryptids of the Corn podcast. I am the great and very tired Mr. E.
And I am Jay Clone 42.
The famous contrarian.
Didn't you know that?
Oh my gosh.
Hear that mic movement?
Why didn't you just...
It just was out of spot, you know. We're professional podcasters, and sometimes you just got to move the mic.
We got to get the nice crocodile mic stands.
Crocodile mic stands?
Yeah, they don't make noise.
Oh, nice.
So let me put that on your shopping list.
Cool.
Spend $4,000 on them. I think they're like $150 each.
I need a loan.
I do too.
What do they call those loans that you don't have to pay back?
Bailouts.
Oh.
You got to be a bank, though.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Printing your own money.
Yeah. No, okay. So we're going to talk. This is going to be our first ever...
Redo? Revisit?
You just looked up the word.
It wasn't the right word.
What was the word you looked up?
I said like reprieve or something.
What's reprieve mean?
It's not that. It's not that. What's reprieve mean?
You see, I would have said reprieve.
Reprieve is to cancel or postpone the punishment of someone, especially someone condemned to death under a new regime. So it's like a...
It's like when the new dictator takes over, everybody that the old dictator put on death row.
Yeah, it's like...
You're on a reprieve until I get a look at your cases.
Right, basically. So, a little different. Close.
Same thing.
Close, but no cigar.
We're going to talk about the Trannies Alps Giant Salmon. We're going to do a full episode. We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff with it. We're going to talk about our survey and the Kickstarter, which the link is below, which we'll talk more about here in a little bit.
Which, when did we do with this last one? What season, what episode? Do you remember? I can't remember. Was it season 2?
Season 1, episode 41.
Oh my gosh, you're just pulling that out of your hat.
Will you talk for a minute?
Well, I know it's...
Why don't you share for a second what... I know why I fell in love with this thing.
Okay.
But you also did too. And I always kind of wonder what is the big thing about this that really hooked you.
I just think that the evidence of it being there and the fact that there isn't a salamander species of that size, taking up that niche in that area where it's supposed to be and where it is everywhere else around the world. And here it's just not here. So it just... the fact that it could be out there and there's evidence that it's, there's space for it to be out there and that it has been seen out there in the past just leads me to believe that it's still there. There's some part of it is still there. And that's what the mystery is there's a potential for it to be rediscovered, and it's already on that list to be reinstated.
Which we'll talk about.
Once it is rediscovered.
Yeah, so it's sitting in the California government's kind of gray list to where there's like three or four species it's actually sitting with that have only been the other two were other. There's two salamanders besides the Trinity's Alps and a toad. So it's an amphibian group.
Okay.
Both the salamanders had only been seen one specimen, and then they were never seen again. So what they, you know, they're not sure if it was, this is before we had genetic technologies like we do now.
Right.
But they weren't sure if it was an oddball of a species that just happened to look really strange or its own new species.
Right.
So they have it set up. If anybody finds a second one for those other two salamanders and the toad, basically they'll get endangered species protection immediately. And the Trinity's Alps is also sitting in that gray zone ready to go.
Right.
And it's mostly, like Jay was saying, the eyewitnesses were so incredibly credible that it was enough to really, it's, and you know, we believe in Bigfoot. I think Bigfoot's out there. I think Bigfoot deserves endangered species protection. But you know, a lot of Bigfoot eyewitnesses are just people, which,
right,
you know, there's nothing wrong. It's just, as far as a government standing for, that makes legislation, Joe Smo, truck driver, seen a Bigfoot. Okay, I can't do anything with that.
Right.
Three primatologists came out and were like, no, there's this, this, and this. You know, that's different. As far as the government's concerned.
Because they're adding their credentials to it. Yes,
they're putting their name on the line for it.
Right.
Season 1, episode 39 was the original episode. Oh,
you're two off.
I knew it was early, right at the end of season 1.
That's pretty good, yes, though.
Because it was the summer, early, it was like May, June of 2 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember when we recorded it, but I remember doing it. And, you know, the main reason we're revisiting this is because we are assembling the greatest salamander discovering herpetology team in the nation.
And I have, we'll do the original, we're going to do the Trinity's Alps episode, and then we're going to go through everybody. And there's a couple more people that want to join that have super high credentials.
So, you know, you get this
interesting enough, a race car filmer, like films high speed stuff,
yeah,
really wants in to do some of the filming.
All right.
Which is just, I love it. It's just, yeah, it's interesting to me. But yeah, so the mystery salamander from Northern California. So I have we're going to just do the basic article. This is from Mysterious Universe. But yeah, the Trinity's Alps is located in the Klamath Mountain systems between the Californian coastal range to the western of the Cascade Mountains to the east. The surrounding Trinity's Alps wilderness area is a vast area encompassing three national forests covering a staggering 517,000 acres.
That's a lot of acres.
Yeah. Making it the second largest designated wilderness area in California, which California is already a huge state. California is one of those weird states where you, when you, you know, a lot of people say California, you think of maybe like Hollywood and right, those beaches. It's most of the West Coast is California.
It's
from
huge.
The Baja Peninsula. All the way up to, you know, to the Redwood Forest.
Right, yep.
So we're definitely talking about the forested part of the state, the mountainous part of the state.
From Mexico to Oregon, basically.
Yeah.
It's California.
Yeah.
They got, like, every different biome in their one state.
They have a lot of regional species, too, of, like, rosy boas and stuff like that.
Oh, rosy boas.
Yeah, me and Emily bred rosy boas for a little bit.
Oh, that's cute.
They're, like, they're the derpiest-looking snakes.
Okay.
You ever seen a rubber boa?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe, but I don't know.
You ever seen a snake that didn't look like it was real? Like, it had a really goofy-looking face?
Okay.
That's them.
Okay.
They look like a rubber snake.
Gotcha.
And they just, yeah, they give live birth. They're fun. Oh, yeah, I thought you were waving at me.
Oh, no. Grabbing my coffee.
So, within the sweeping vastness of this pristine mountain wilderness lives a flourishing variety of wildlife, including large species such as bears, deer, mountain lions, wolverines, as well as a numerous amount of smaller species of mammals, reptiles, and birds. You know, we always make the joke, or you always make the joke about the Tennessee being the most biodiverse place on the planet.
It is?
Especially for salamanders.
What?
Yes.
Breaking news.
Breaking news. this part of California is up there too for salamanders because there's a lot of tree-bound salamander species.
Oh, tree-bound.
That have prehensile tails and stuff like that that live in the canopy almost their whole lives.
What are they, like ancient salamander species?
No, they look like monkeys.
Salamander monkeys?
Mm-hmm.
Nah, come on.
Yeah.
Now you're jumping off the deep end.
Among these plethora of thriving biodiversity, there also exists another large species, the Trannies Alps giant salamander, with reports putting it all the way up to 10 feet in length. It's been reported in this region for decades. So this region is hard to get to, which is good and bad for us.
Right.
Which makes it good that makes it's probably still out there and why there's not tons of sightings.
There's not people to see it.
Yeah, because it's hard to get to. The people that go there don't have the equipment to really mess around. You get to the top of these mountains and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the rivers are protected fully by valleys.
Mm.
So like there's mountains on both sides of them. You can't really get to them without hopping over the mountain. That's going to be your job carrying your camera.
Hey, I'll do it.
It's going to suck.
How much is it going to cost to get like to parachute in off a like a private helicopter or a plane?
Let's deal with this first Kickstarter.
Because I think once if we hit this goal, we can, you know, make a stretch goal and have me parachute down in.
If we hit the goal, sure.
Okay, cool.
Like 20 grand.
I'll do it. I'll do it.
We'll just rent a helicopter.
You guys put me up to it. I'll do it.
Helicopters aren't incredibly hard to rent.
Okay.
I think we could charter one for probably like 10 grand to drop us off.
And I could just jump out with a parachute, right?
I think they just drop you off.
Oh, or that too. Yeah, that'd be sweet.
So the modern mystery of the Trannies Alps giant salamander started back as far as, you know, 1920s. It's kind of when our modern sightings start. When a hunter by the name of Franklin L. Griffith, which I called Griffin in the original episode, was hunting deer in the remote area near the head of the New River when he came across a rather bizarre sight. At the bottom of the lake, he reported seeing five enormous salamanders, and he described them as ranging from 2 to 3 meters, 5 to 9 feet long. So, yeah. He sees five massive salamanders. So 5 to 9 feet, we're going to talk about some prehistoric North American salamanders. But the modern-day giant Japanese, giant Chinese, they can get 5 to 6 feet, 5 to 6.5 feet. There's some evidence to say they may have got 7 feet long, you know, before a lot of predation of humans mm-hmm. and the degradation of habitat and stuff like that. So this is right up giant salamanders, modern-day giant salamanders alley.
Are they smaller now because that oxygen in the atmosphere doesn't allow them to grow to the sizes they used to grow to before, you know, in the past when the Earth had an oxygen-rich environment?
Probably not, since they're in the water and they breathe through their skin.
Remember that from the I'm making a joke from the the arachnids, or not the arachnids, that's spiders, but the
the scorpions and why during the Carnivorous period insects and invertebrates were so big.
Right. That giant centipede.
Giant centipede episode.
Yeah.
And it really had, most scientists agree now that it probably had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, they taught us that in school, like growing up.
Because like sauropods had pretty much, the giant dinosaurs had pretty much the same oxygen level we have now.
Right, but they were.
They just had a really cool respiratory system.
And they were just humongous.
They actually had like, essentially imagine like mini lungs.
All up their neck, right?
Yeah, down their neck and in some parts of their chest.
Hmm.
So they had a really, just a really, really cool respiratory system, which makes sense. Most animals just do that.
Yeah, have cool systems to you know, live in the cool environment.
Yeah, so this fascinated hunter went about trying to catch one of these strange creatures with a hook and a line. And allegedly, he had some success. But the massive creature provided too strong for him, and he was forced to give it up and let it swim back down into the bottom of the river to join the others.
Hmm.
And that makes sense. I've dealt with hellbenders and some. Salamanders are remarkably strong.
Yeah.
They just kind of get this idea that they're
weak from being vulnerable.
Yeah, especially a 6-foot salamander.
Yeah.
I've watched people mess with giant Japanese salamanders and stuff like that and get the poop beat out of them.
With them trying to get away or?
Yeah, just them just not wanting to be picked up.
Yeah.
And they're like seals. They're like little seals. They're strong. They don't, and they're slimy.
Right.
And they're
hard. Yeah. Hard to hang on to.
And if he's having a 7 or 8 foot long salamander on the line, that's a man. You know, you're pulling in another man.
That's fight. That can swim in the water and fight back. Swim well.
Yeah. So it's, you know, that makes sense. I've seen some people say, well, how, you know, if he had it on the hook and line, how could he not? And salamanders are easy to catch on hook and line.
Yeah.
We catch them ice fishing all the time. We catch mud puppies in super deep water, and they smell food and they come up to eat. Like, they're not that hard to trick. So, where was I? The frustrated Griffith would leave the scene empty-handed, but would never forget what he saw that day. It was with this story that a long, weird history of the giant salamander sightings in the Trinity Alps region would begin, with numerous eyewitness accounts coming in from all similar, describing a very large salamander ranging from the 5 to 10 feet in length, dark brown to black coloration. The sightings then would turn to a launch of various expeditions into the Trinity Alps wilderness in order to try to find these endemic monsters. Yeah, so where are we at so far? What are you thinking?
I'm thinking we're going to find this thing. I'm just getting all jacked up from, I mean, hearing more about it, just, you know, just putting the pieces together. Your mind's just wandering. It's, we're going to freaking find this thing.
One of the first serious attempts to find a specimen of the Trinity Alps giant salamander was made by a biologist named Thomas L. Rogers. Inspired by the 1920s Griffith's account and scattered sightings that had been made since, Rogers, it's like Rogers with a D in the middle.
That's still Rogers.
Is it really?
Yeah, Rogers.
Well, everybody knows they can't read.
Yes.
Would end up mounting a total of 4 separate expeditions into Trinity's wilderness over the years to scour the region for any signs of the beast. Rogers, was unable to locate neither any specimen nor evidence of them. However, his team was able to find numerous specimens of giant Pacific salamanders, which is a local salamander that can grow up to be about 12 inches long. Before I continue, I want to talk about Griffith's sighting.
Okay.
The 5 salamanders, and I kind of shortened it up for this.
Sorry. Big cup.
I kind of shortened it up for this. But they were chasing each other, he kind of described.
Mm.
They were kind of following. The biggest one was in the head, and then all these other ones were following it, which is giant salamander mating behavior.
Okay, so the salamanders were chasing each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was kind of like a conga line, ooh, which is kind of whether it's – so males will kind of fight, depending on if we're talking about giant Japanese or hellbenders, uh-huh, North American giant. They'll rip each other apart.
Yeah.
And then, but sometimes they'll chase females.
Okay.
So if the one in the front's the big, you know, big female, and the males are just chasing her, that could be what was happening too.
Mm, makes sense.
Or it could have been a couple females, a couple males, you know, yeah, 5 animals.
Conga line their way out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. Although none of these specimens were more than a foot long, Rogers came up with a theory that the cryptid giant Trinity's Alps salamander could be a type of, now here's the name for the family name for the giant Pacific salamander, Desicamprodiidae, that somehow, perhaps through genetic isolation or geographic isolation, had developed a sort of gigantism.
Okay.
Now, I love his theory. That's probably not what happened.
If we, all right, never mind. Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, I was just, okay. If we can, okay, let's say we find one of these guys, and we find a specimen baby, we bring him home. And we start raising him. We got to name him Andre.
Well, we'll talk about Andreas here just in a second, actually.
Okay.
That's my next line. Before I continue, I did want to give an update to everybody. I didn't do this in the beginning.
Ooh.
My wife, Emily, has been in the hospital for about a week and a half as of recording this. Will be 2.5 weeks by the time you hear this. Our twin girls were trying to come early. But we got to the hospital, and they're doing a great job of keeping them in. So my appearances on the show may be a little spotty over the next little bit. Jay's done a great job of recording some stuff, like this whole last week you heard with Michael and some other guest hosts and stuff like that. So thank you, Jay, for doing that. It may continue to happen. You know, we kind of talked. There may be some more.
So it's a different flavor for the time being.
I haven't heard of them, so.
Okay.
I haven't.
First one just came out yesterday.
Yeah,
as a recording this.
But yeah. So if everybody can keep my wife in your prayers and in your thoughts and everything like that, I would greatly appreciate it. Okay. He also theorized that the giant salamander could be a new type of giant related to the Asian giants. These truly huge creatures inhabit streams and rivers in Japan and China, and they actually just, we talked about this last time, discovered a new species of giant Chinese salamander.
Okay.
Very recently.
Here's a thought, though. It just hit me. I don't, mm-hmm, know why. Is there any chance the Trinity's Alps giant salamander could be a Pacific salamander? However, just over time, the Pacific salamanders have shrunk in time to fill like whatever niche they're in now.
Probably not. It'd probably be the other way around.
Okay.
That they got giant to take that niche, not the vice versa.
Because
they don't have any giants in their lineage, as far as I know.
Okay. I don't know. Just thought.
Just through the fossil record, you know, they're kind of that, the West Coast version of a mole salamander. They kind of fit that size and everything like that.
Okay.
You know, ground, you living under logs and in the dirt and stuff like that, but coming out to breed and stuff.
Saying so, just shrink.
You know, 12 to 14 inches is kind of as big as those niches allow them to get, because then they get too big and predators start taking advantage of them.
Yeah.
Because they can't hide as well. As far as I know, we always call them dog salamanders, the Depro, the big long name I said a minute ago.
You're right, right.
As far as I know, they don't have any giants in their lineage.
Okay.
Like, so the Andreas, like Andreas Japicanus, the giant Japanese salamander.
It's even better. We got to name Andre the giant salamander.
We'll talk about it. You know, they get 5 feet long on average. Can they be up to 100 pounds? The biggest one, I believe, was 135 pounds. And the giant Chinese salamander, which is Andreas Davaconus, was our biggest one of that, is 6 feet long and about 150 pounds.
Dang.
Both are what is known as cryptobranchiates, which is the Cryptobranchiidae family, a group of large salamanders that pretty much cover the whole northern hemisphere.
Okay.
Like we talked about, the hellbender is also the North American member to this family group. And recently there was a European one that went extinct in the last, you know, several thousand years.
Okay, right.
And we believe could be the tadpole worm, and some even the Loch Ness sightings could be a giant salamander.
Yeah, can be. You got to open your minds.
Cryptobranchius is famous for having the large flat bodies with the frills on the side, which they actually use to breathe.
Are hellbenders only on the East Coast?
And the Ozarks.
Right, right, right.
Which is the middle of the country.
Right, yeah. But nothing west.
No.
Nothing west of the Rocky Mountains.
So what, and we'll talk about their evolution here in a bit, because hellbenders are 150 million years old.
Right, they're super old.
So they kind of got stopped by the inland sea.
Okay.
Which is, you know, the Ozarks would have been kind of on the edge of that.
Okay, gotcha.
So most of these salamanders, even the giant Chinese and Japanese, live in clean mountain streams. You're hitting the mic, making all kinds of noise.
I just had to sneeze and I had to fight it for like 10 seconds.
So the giant Chinese theory was bolstered by a paper in the scientific journal written by herpetologist George S. Mayers in 1951, who agreed that the Chinese Alps giant salamander could be a type of giant Asian salamander in the genus Andreas, also called Megobranchiates, which just means the big hidden gill, to provide his own bizarre firsthand sighting to prove it. Mayers allegedly came across a specimen of an Asian giant salamander that was captured in the Sacramento River in 1939 by a fisherman. We're going to come back to this.
Okay.
I have problems with all of this.
Okay.
The fisherman claimed that the creature had been tangled in one of his catfishing nets. The Mayers went to investigate when he saw the giant salamander that resembled, to his words, a giant Asian salamander, except the coloring, which was a dark brown instead of its usual slate gray or yellow, which are not found. So this dark brown is not really found in the Asian populations
right. In
that day. Mayers was also allowed to examine the specimen up close, and he wrote of this of his discovery. So I'm going to read his thing, and then we're going to talk about
it.
The animal was a fine Megobranchius in perfect condition, between 25 and 30 inches in length. The source of the specimen, of course, is unknown. Its strange coloration was even suggested to be possibly a native Californian Megobranchius, which would not be surprising. But no others have been captured or been reported to me.
Okay.
So he was a herpetologist in his day.
Right.
This fisherman caught an Asian giant salamander-ish.
Right.
The article was written in the magazine kind of is misleading. It almost makes it seem like he said it was a giant Chinese salamander.
Mm-hmm.
No, he said it was a Megobranchius. It was a family in the family of the Asian giant salamanders.
Doesn't mean it's what it was.
Yes, right. Just one of them.
Right.
Not a Chinese giant salamander in the Sacramento River. In 1951, we have trouble transporting hellbenders 100 miles for reintroduction without them dying.
So imagine when it being caught in that.
1951, transferring it from China.
Nope. This was 39, I thought.
Oh, yeah, sorry. It was 1939. He wrote about it in 51.
Right.
1939, transferring it from China across the ocean by boat and throwing it in the Sacramento River.
Just to be caught in a net and living.
Yeah. The Sacramento River's headwaters is the Trinity's Alps. Just by the way.
Ooh.
So I think he's right as far as, but the article is, and he describes it as being pretty much the same body plan, which when you look at a hellbender and you look at a giant Japanese salamander, they are remarkably similar.
It's just size difference.
It's just size difference.
Right.
And it's really prey abundance and stuff like that. And I think hellbenders probably could get 35 or 40 inches. If they were allowed to be healthy again.
Given the right environment.
Yeah, before colonization of North America, they probably got 35 or 40 inches long.
And hellbenders are red-listed, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You guys will hear about that on Friday.
Yeah, that's right.
So freaky. Myers here had what I believe was an adult or a juvenile specimen, you know, 30 inches long. And he's talking about the coloration. So if you look at our t-shirt, it comes with a Kickstarter. That's kind of what it highlights, this brown with these green splotches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's very different than the giant Japanese and the giant Chinese.
Right.
Giant Chinese are almost always that almost slate gray and randomly orange.
Okay.
And it's kind of like a phenotype. A physical, just one pops up every once in a while that's orange. Salamanders kind of do that. They kind of have an oddball coloration every once in a while in their
like
genetics.
Like when you're down at the pond here at the college and you got all them carp. And like every one in like 30 of them are orange.
Oh, yeah.
Like goldfish.
And same with the giant Japanese. The giant Japanese almost, they have more mottling, which is spots.
Okay.
But they're almost always dark with light.
Dark with
like
light
really
spots.
Dark. Like black or really, really dark. This is a brown with green.
Yeah. Okay.
Which would make it sense where it's living. You know, it's just different coloration to fit in. But if you just took a specimen from China and threw it in the waters in California, it wouldn't change. It may lighten up or darken up, but it's not going to change color this dramatically. Do you have any questions about Myers? This is a herpetologist, a man that studied in China and Japan giant salamanders and happened to be there in California when one was caught.
When one was caught,
and
yeah, exactly.
Fully agrees that it was a cryptobranchiid, and he said he wouldn't be surprised if it was a native species.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So to me, that's right there, you know.
That says a lot.
Yeah. And this is, you know, 1939, you know, we're getting to where California is starting to get really starting to be settled.
Right.
And I'll read another report from one being caught in the same river further upstream that was just dead. And it was actually, or no, I don't believe it was dead. It was put on display.
I wonder if.
So Christian, one of the cameramen that's coming.
Oh, yes.
He sent me this article he found in his research.
Ooh, okay.
And this is from Peterborough, California, April 6th. I believe this is in the 40s. The newspaper article does not have a date. Peterborough, California, April 6th. It says, water yields animal looking like salamander. I don't know why they say it like that. It's just, you know, we've read a lot of weird articles on
right,
this.
Right, yeah.
The depths of the nearby river give us today a creature that may not be maybe an unusually large salamander, or maybe something even more unusual. The thing apparently has an amphibian as a flat body by 18 inches long, 6 inches wide at its greatest width, 4 legs, and a flat tail that's another 12 inches long. So what do we got? 18 plus 12, we have 30 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So 30 inches of flat head, big flat tail.
Yeah.
Salamander.
Exactly.
Sorry, let me find it again. It is grayish with tan spots. So we're fitting almost the same description, gray-brown with spots. It had a weight estimated of over 30 pounds, but it was too lively to get on the scales to get an accurate check. And everybody, like we said, handling salamanders, it's like they're called snot otters for a reason.
Yeah, good luck.
It was found near Sherman Island in the Salvatore Marconi of 534 York Street. And a man and his son, John, were there catfishing with nets. So this was a popular way to fish during the time. They discovered what they hauled up in the nets was from 30 feet below the surface. Alvin Shields, a superintendent of an aquarium nearby, was sent by telegraph the description of the creature, and he said it was in the salamander family. But he said it was unusual to find such a large salamander in this region. He thought it may have been thrown overboard by a ship's crewmen brought from Central or South America.
Okay.
Which makes no sense to me. There's no giant aquatic salamanders.
Down there, yeah.
I think he was kind of thinking it was a crocodilian.
Okay. That would make more sense.
The amateur science here are comparing the thing to pictures of salamanders. We're certain that it was something slightly different. They said it was a miraculous discover. It had a flatter head and a body than normal salamanders. And it's definitely different kind of tail. Which, in my opinion, they're probably comparing it to, like, the giant Pacific salamander, which has the round head and a normal, like, a lizard-like tail.
Not the flat tail, yeah. Like the rudder.
Yeah, cryptobranchiids, you know, the closest ones are the Japanese and the hellbender, which are both thousands of miles away.
And very different.
Yeah. So in, you know, the 1940s, they don't have access. You can't just Google salamander. The creature was then taken to the miraculous home to sit on a tank bottom for most of the time. But it comes up to the surface occasionally as if to get air. One of the men said he handled it, said it was terribly powerful. T.L. Rogers, no D., curator of the reptiles and amphibians at the University of California, said he'd never seen anything like this creature in his experience. And then they started charging. They had over 700 residents come and see it. They charged 10 cents per visitor.
Nice.
The animal eventually did die in captivity.
Yeah, that's to be expected.
So I've seen people say these are the same story. I've seen people say these are different stories. I kind of think they're different stories. Some of the names are kind of similar. Because Rogers was the original sighting, the original guy that seen it. This is a Rogers from years later.
Without the D in his Rogers.
Yes. Myers was the scientist in the story I just told you.
Yeah.
And Rogers was the scientist in that story.
And then,
Some people, some of the researchers, I think, get them kind of confused.
Conflate the two together.
There's a lot of similarities and similar names.
Right.
So, as far as the original specimen caught out of the river, it's not known what really ever happened to it. After years, Meyer did publish his paper, reported handling the animal. He had, like I said, the animal handler named Vern Hardin reported seeing dozens of giant salamanders in the remote Herbert Lake of the Trans Alps, which he described as being up to 8 feet long. Hardin also claimed that he had hooked one on the line, just as it happened with Griffith in the 1920s. The monster salamander proved too formidable to bring up to the surface and was then torn loose. This report was heard by none other than the man that the lake was named after himself, Jesuit scholar Father Herbert, Hubbard.
Elrond?
Yeah.
Oh.
Who was also an avid explorer and naturalist. Hubbard was first highly skeptical of the reports of a giant salamander in the Trans-Alps region, but upon analyzing other similar sightings in the region, he had a change of heart and started to think that there might be something to these stories. In fact, eventually he became so convinced that there could be a giant salamander in the Trans-Alps region, he put together several expeditions in the search of them. Along with his brother, Captain John D. Hubbard, between the years of 1958 and 1959, Hubbard later claimed to have seen these creatures himself during these excursions, but he actually had established their existence. But since no evidence had been brought back or put forward to support these claims, it is unknown whether they just what they found. In fact, there has been some who doubt these expeditions ever took place at all.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Nevertheless, these tales of Hubbard's expedition searching the Trans-Alps giant salamander was intriguing enough to catch the attention of a legendary oil tycoon and millionaire.
Oh, no.
And cryptid hunter, Tom Slick.
Tom Slick. All right. He's back in the picture.
Before we move on to Tom Slick. So, yeah, he's a father, Jesuit father, naturalist. A lot of those guys were naturalists.
Okay.
Like Punnett Squares, do you know that came from a Catholic monk.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he was studying peas in his garden.
Yeah.
And the colors of the peas. And so these priests, these Jesuit fathers, they spend a lot of time in temple.
Right.
So they work on a lot of nature stuff,
they can't be the science. I'm the science.
So it just is interesting to me that, this guy was from the area. The lake they were seeing is named after him.
Right. Hubbard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Herbert.
Herbert.
No. Or Hubbard. No, you said Hubbard. Gosh. Hubbard.
Hubbard.
Yeah. Hubbard. Like Elrond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and he went on several expeditions and ended up claiming to see him. And then later on, people said, he didn't see him at all. He's probably the main reason it's on the Californian list.
Him alone.
Yeah. Because he discovered several other species that got fully documented.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we talked about it with like Steller. Steller had the Steller sea apes.
Sea cows.
In the middle of all of his
other
discoveries, like the sea cow.
And the bird.
Yeah. He didn't talk about it like it was a monster. He just like, seen this, and then I seen this, and then I seen this.
Like another animal.
Yeah. Right in the middle. Any questions? What are your thoughts so far?
It's funny that you bring that up, that, it was an old, priest that come up with the Punnett Square. That's like the main thing in diversity in biology, basically.
For genetics.
I
can't remember his name, he's called the modern father of genetics.
And it's just funny, I don't know, a lot of that stuff.
I can't remember if he was a Catholic priest.
It's just funny how everything...
But he was a religious man.
Religious
figure.
Everything we kind of view in that aspect nowadays is separated, as religion on one hand or quote-unquote science on the other hand. When it's so much more similar, or the same thing... It shouldn't really be that separated
as it
is right now. There's certain things, sure, but
everybody knows I'm a Christian. I'm a biologist. I do all kinds of stuff. They don't have to be separate,
right?
And I don't know when that started.
I don't know either. It's like it's framed that way.
I actually don't want to say. I think I know when it started. I don't want to say. Anything about
after World War II?
No, before
World War I?
Yes.
Okay.
So Tom Slick, the man, the myth, the legend. Is his sticky note still up behind me?
It is. I drew it.
A long time ago, we did an episode on Tom Slick. Actually, I think that's how we found out about the Trans Alps Giant Salamander.
It might be, yeah.
Because I think we were like, oh, what is this? He did this because he hunted the Bigfoot, and then he hunted the Yeti.
I'm going to have to go back and revisit Tom Slick. That was season one, too. It had to have been.
Early, like in the 20s.
Yeah, it was early season one. Tom Slick, the famous cryptid hunter and millionaire.
He's a millionaire then, but would have been a billionaire now.
Now, yeah.
But so Tom Slick, who had sourced the wilds of the world searching for cryptids such as Bigfoot and the Yeti, Slick was fascinated with the stories of the Trans Alps Giant Salamander, especially the accounts given by Hubbard. And so in 1960, so this is just a year after Hubbard was, his expeditions were done.
Right.
He took some of the people who were working on the Pacific Northwest on the expedition to find Bigfoot, which we'll talk about here in a minute, to try to locate a specimen of this mysterious giant salamander. Keep in mind, these people were specialists in probably finding something like Bigfoot, not a salamander, very different fields.
Yeah.
The reason he did this, okay, I'll finish this little sentence and I'll tell you this. You may remember, you may not. So the team members begrudgingly went along with the plan, even though they thought it was a distraction from their main purpose and a waste of time. So the people that he was paying a lot of money to look
thought it was a waste of time
and didn't want to do it because they wanted to go hunt Bigfoot.
Yeah.
So the expedition, after a successive search of several quote unquote, the expedition did fail and any evidence for the Trans Alps was never found. And they didn't even manage to spot They're one of the few early expeditions that didn't even see one.
Didn't see it at all.
A lot of the other ones, like, oh, they're there. They're just hard to catch.
Right.
Which people we'll talk about David and other people. Research hellbenders.
Yeah.
That's how hellbenders are.
Hard to catch.
They're hard to find.
Right.
And then we know they're here.
We're going to find one.
So the Tom Slick thing.
We're going to find it.
Well, we are. The Tom Slick thing. These people, he put together his team to hunt Bigfoot. And they could not get along. Do you remember this yet?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they were fighting, and there was the two main guys of the expedition could not get along.
Right.
And he's like, I'm putting all this money for you guys to go look, and you're acting like children.
Right.
So you're going to go, and this is like, the Trans Alps thing was like a team building exercise.
Right.
Essentially, because he's like, this is cheaper, I can get you here, and I can watch you, because I can't go with you to the Bigfoot one.
Right.
But so, I can go here and make sure you guys...
Make you wade around in a river together and be miserable.
And this is kind of the reason the Bigfoot one kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
Is because the two main guys of the Bigfoot expedition just could not get together.
Couldn't work together.
And complete kids. Literally, a billionaire of the day
right.
was giving you a checkbook
be like
to go find Bigfoot.
Be like Bill Gates walking out of
New York. And your test was to find a salamander. Yeah. And you're like, I don't want to do that. It's stupid.
Yeah.
And you fought. And he's like, all right, well, here's like 5 cents.
See, now they don't give you like 5 cents. They just give you, a bullet.
There's not many Tom Slicks left in the world.
No, they're evil and corrupt.
As far as a millionaire or a billionaire, because his dad was the oil tycoon. He was an oil tycoon. He took over his dad's oil fields.
Right.
I think he was a good man. I mean, we talked about several universities in Texas. Like, he built the cryptid park.
Right.
In Texas that we want to go visit.
Bad.
It has like a Nessie and Bigfoot. And all, like, he built that.
Tom Slick park. I think Tom Slick was one of the good ones.
I think it's because he didn't make his money. So money came from oil.
Right.
His dad was the oil baron.
He wasn't the cutthroat person cutting deals, shaking babies.
The money was already there, and he's like, all right, well, let's go find cryptids.
Right, yeah. Used it for good.
It didn't work. So like I said, the team begrudgingly. Yeah, so nevertheless, it was said that Tom Slick especially enjoyed this expedition as it was close to home, and he was able to bring along his sons. So this was his Tom Slick plan.
So this would be if you were a billionaire, you would be having salamander expeditions every other month.
Oh yeah, no, we
come on kids.
I would own the Trans Alps.
Yeah, exactly.
I would own it, protect them.
Exactly.
We're going to talk about that. If you want the full Tom Slick life story, Lauren Coleman's has an amazing book about it.
Oh, cool. Okay.
That is Tom Slick: The True Life Encounters in Cryptozoology.
Okay.
I love Lauren Coleman. I love Lauren Coleman's book. I own a lot of them. I don't own this one yet. It'll be on my list. But it kind of details his whole life and kind of how Tom started doing this stuff.
Cool.
So in September of 1960, the same year Tom Slick had gone off searching for the salamanders, three zoology professors, we're going to go with their names, Stebbins of the University of California, Rogers, Tom Rogers, Cairo State College, and Nathan Cohen of a modest junior college mounted their own expedition in search of these creatures. This was not Tom Rogers' first formal into the Trinity's Alps search. He had already made several unsuccessful expeditions in the 1948. He was the very same Thomas Rogers,
who
had connected the theory of the oversized. Yeah, he was the one that seen the...
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's okay. We're all on the same page now.
Yep. So he was the one that seen the dead one
right
from the fishing net and said this up. is a cryptobranchian.
Yep.
Although the pedigree of the team leadership was very impressive, they were accompanied by 10 laymen who had little scientific training or expedition experience.
I know a Tim Layman. That's funny.
10.
Oh, 10.
Not Tim Layman.
Oh, darn it.
The expedition was able to locate at least a dozen of the known giant Pacific salamanders, but none of the over foot long impressive, but none over 8-foot salamanders they were looking for.
Well, maybe they did find something. They just didn't know.
We'll save it for the end.
Okay.
This is the very same sort of expedition Robert had previously had. He grew skeptical of the existence of anything larger in the area. Things were made worse by the continued misidentification by the less experienced team members of sunken logs for giant salamanders. And they came to the conclusion that the Trinity's Alps giant salamander was merely a product of misidentification and tall tales.
Mm.
He treated the failure of the final expedition as more or less the debunking of the mysterious creature. And he would have a paper outlining his skepticism in 1962. Although taking the lack of results as proof as the creature didn't exist at all to the bit extreme, he nevertheless dampened any scientific curiosity for the creature with his paper.
Okay.
So he may have been overzealous with debunking it.
Right.
Not finding it. And he took his anger out on the scientific community.
Right.
And the scientific community seen this paper and was like, okay, well, there's nothing here.
Yeah.
And that sucks because this is 1962.
Right.
This is when North American aquatic biology really starts exploding. And we had the Clean Water Act come in a couple years. And we start really looking at this stuff.
Okay.
So I really think, not to his, it's whatever, but I really think this paper was probably why it hasn't been discovered yet.
Okay.
Because it was overlooked because of this paper.
If we end up, God forbid, not finding it, which ain't going to happen, we're going to find this thing. We're going to discover this. We're professional podcasters. We're professional salamander hunters. We're going to find it. If we don't, though... We should go full on scorched earth like this guy. And
yeah, no, thank you.
Doesn't exist.
So although taking the lack of, to the big extreme, we came rather obscure even in cryptozoology footnotes. One of the last major mainstream expeditions undertaken to find the Trinity's Alps giant salamander was by a Japanese American writer and researcher of Native American legends. His first name's Kyle. What was funny?
Okay, hold on. He's Japanese
American who specialized in Native American legends,
and his name's Kyle.
Well, I think he took an American name.
I hope
he was probably born here,
but just a Japanese American named Kyle.
That's Mizuguni is, I think, his last name.
That probably sounds pretty close.
In 1997, Mizuguni mounted a thorough scientific expedition for the hunt of these creatures, but like those before him, was unable to locate any specimens, nor indeed any signs of the creature. So 1997.
Yeah.
No DNA testing.
Okay.
This one. The lack of any evidence for the Trinity's Alps giant salamander besides scattered sighting reports does not make a strong case for alleged existence. But the idea of a giant salamander living in the area of undiscovered is not completely far-fetched because, like we just said, they just discovered a new species of giant Chinese salamander.
Yep.
That was in a populated area that nobody knew existed.
Mm-hmm.
And that giant Japanese salamanders have recently been found living in rice fields. They didn't know were there either.
Uh-huh.
So we're talking, there are 6-foot-long salamanders living in town.
Right,
that nobody knew were there. And then obviously the hellbender is known for being a hidden man. So let's talk about this. Well, so that's kind of the end of the article. That's kind of really where we stopped on our first episode.
Yeah.
The Northern Hemisphere... Every mountain range with clear cold water streams, except one, has a giant salamander in modern history. The European one was the other one that was missing, but they just found fossil evidence of it, and it was probably hunted to extinction at the end of its lifetime.
Okay.
Due to people thinking like the tassel worm. We talked about fire salamanders being persecuted in Europe for being thought associated with witchcraft and starting fires. They're just a salamander.
That's funny. I was going to say they were hunted because of witches.
They were. They were associated with witchcraft.
Yeah.
They didn't do anything.
You're right.
They just lived, and they were almost wiped out because they were associated with witchcraft.
Poor guys.
And it seems like the same thing was happening with the giant European salamander. And that the last parts they were seen as like Scandinavian, some parts of that, where they were called like tassel worms and linden worms and stuff like this, to where when they, every time they're being seen, they're being stabbed, you know, and killed. So they were wiped out and recently rediscovered. So that leaves one mountain range, the Pacific Northwest mountain range, is it. There's no salamander, the giant salamander there, which makes no sense. But this may be it. This may, there still may be one, and they may be extremely reclusive.
Just can't find them. You need the special, the right team. A team that was built just to discover these guys. A team that was assembled to be the ones to rediscover these guys.
So remember, the only link below these episodes this week is the Kickstarter link. If you can't support it, if you think we can find this, we appreciate it. But we're going to talk about where we think these teams may have gone. Not wrong. They didn't have the tools necessary for these expeditions. There has been a couple more modern ones. Ken Gerhard just did one, which you're going to be talking to him in a couple weeks about.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to be seeing him soon.
Yeah. I won't be.
Well, you know.
You will
the
be.
The royal we.
The royal we. So he's going to share some information about his, you know, his adventures out there.
Before we get to the explanation of where, you know, where they could have
steered. Oh, should we do an ad break?
Yeah. We got any Bigfoot breath?
Give me a second.
On hand? Because I've got a hankering for some food.
All right. We'll be back after these messages. Suey! I got me this hot, fresh squonk steak, but man, it tastes bad. Jay, you got anything to fix this up?
I think you need some seasoning on that squonk fixer up.
Well, what do you got?
How about you try this right here? It's called Bigfoot Breath. Raw garlic seasoning made from fresh garlic.
Oh, give me that. That's. Well, it did make it taste a lot better. Jeez.
Brought that squonk right alive, didn't it?
You know, I'm going to have to kill more squonks to use more of this seasoning.
Oh, how about you try this instead? How about you try my spicy garlic seasoning?
Oh, give it here. Suey! That's good stuff.
Spicy, but not too spicy.
That's perfect. Where can you get these delicacies?
Oh, you can find these on flavorsforest.com. This is our newest spice that's just been created, and it's from Flavors of the Forest.
Make sure you all get some at the links down below. We'll catch you. Suey!
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing some more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she's decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over the 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. My dog Grace loves it. She just gobbles it up. Go check out Badlands Ranch. You can get there at badlandsranch.com/corncrew and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/corncrew today.
And we're back.
Bigfoot breath. Love it.
All right. So we're going to talk about our expedition.
That's right. The Kickstarter.
So a lot of these guys, you know, they were doing the best expeditions they could with the technologies of the time. Our biggest part of our expedition is going to be the DNA sampling.
Yeah.
So there's a picture, if I remember to post it next Monday, of comparing a Pacific salamander neonate, which is an aquatic adult.
Okay.
In a baby Japanese giant salamander, which are the same size, they look almost identical.
Ooh.
So what may be happening is that babies are getting caught and being mis-ID'd as normal giant Pacific salamanders. So that's the big part of our survey.
Well, how do you get, how do you ID them correctly?
Well, but I'm not going to share that publicly.
Oh.
That's our secret sauce in case somebody tries to beat us out there.
Oh, all right, never mind then.
But no, it's going to be DNA sampling. It's going to be the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Because they look so similar that we're going to do, I think, about a couple. We have the ability to do around like 500 or 600 DNA samples with the money that we're getting. And that's going to be the goal. And we're allowed to take a certain amount of specimens back if we really think we get a couple that look very odd compared to the Pacific giant salamander.
Right.
That already lives there. So the DNA sampling juveniles, there's all these similarities. They look identical. I'll post that picture and people, you know, they look like the same thing.
Right.
They're the same color. Their heads are a little bit different when you kind of look at the picture, but not much. As far as larval salamander ID is super hard.
Right. It's one of the hardest things, right?
It is the hardest thing that's invertebrate biology to ID. As far there's that can be argued.
Well, you know, yeah, there's
anybody in vertebrate biology is going to argue that their thing is the hardest thing to do.
Right, there's always a case to be made.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, okay. But salamanders on the whole.
But salamanders that aren't related at all, like the giant Pacific salamander and the giant Japanese salamander,
mm-hmm.
which I know they both have giant in the name. One's 12 inches long. One's 6 foot.
Yeah,
very different.
Different giants.
Their babies look identical. Not related.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just to show you that all these, you know, these people are catching baby salamanders.
Convergent evolution.
Or yeah, just common ancestor.
There you go.
I'm arguing with you. I'm telling you you're wrong.
I know. It's like the opposite. Same difference.
Opposite, actually.
Same difference.
The exact opposite.
Right. But the it's
the same. Different.
But it's the same.
Anyways, that these guys maybe being mis-ID'd. Babies are where you target most of these surveys when we talk about hellbenders and giant Japanese and giant Chinese. We look for them in these territories and stuff like that. So that's going to be the biggest part of it, the DNA survey. This will be the most scientific modern-day expedition ever done as far as just the amount of DNA sampling techniques that are going into it.
And we're in the front lines, crypts of the corn,
yep.
Right in the thick of it.
We also have several permits applied for with the Californian government to maybe allow us to use some traps that are specifically designed for hellbenders that these guys, all these previous expeditions had nothing, they had none of it to do with.
Right.
A lot of these traps weren't designed until the 90s.
Right.
And the last 90s expedition did not have these.
So, again, just a leg up for us.
So
we're finding this thing, people. We are going to find it. We
will have the best crack at it.
Yep. We just
probably
need,
ever.
We just need the funding to get out there to do it. That's all.
Next one is the snorkeling survey with the trapping aspect. So how we kind of do it with this is I'll read the guys' names here in a second, David and Zach and Christian. David and Zach, I worked with Zach. David is currently a herpetologist with the Missouri department. He specializes in hellbenders and stuff like that. How you kind of do these surveys is you snorkel and you look along. You're looking for two things. We're identifying crayfish beds. So we talked about that in the Hellbender episode you'll hear on Friday. Hellbenders specifically co-occur with what's called a crayfish bed, a high population of crayfish. It's their most active part of their diet.
Right.
So that's what we're going to assume is going to be happening over here as well, is that we need to identify crayfish beds because it's going to be the largest part of these guys' diet, especially the babies to the juvenile size. The adults are probably more eating fish and each other.
Mm-hmm.
Giant salamanders are highly cannibalistic. They're fully nocturnal too. You really only see them during the day during breeding. If we look at a lot of the sightings we had, it almost seemed like they were always around breeding events.
Okay.
So that makes a lot of sense as far right. as biology goes.
Why they'd be out. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because they don't come out during the day. And hellbenders specifically, you don't see them. I've watched people with hellbenders right beside them in the river fishing and never see them because they're camouflaged so well.
Mm-hmm.
They're cryptids. They're literally cryptobranchiates. Hidden. So the snorkel survey, what you kind of do, we're looking for denning sites and crayfish beds. So denning sites are these, like we talked about, hellbenders in giant Japanese and giant Chinese will dig these holes out from underneath rocks, or they'll literally in the sides of these cliff faces, they'll be stacked shell,
yeah,
and they'll be in these gaps.
Okay.
So we have two certified scuba divers that are coming. They're going to look in those deep pockets and those stacked shells.
Sweet.
And then the most of us will be doing the survey, which is basically laying on your belly and crawling up the river, looking down and trying to find den sites.
Gotcha.
We find den sites, as long as the permits go through, we will be using, then setting up traps around those den sites. And these are live traps that basically, it's like a big minnow basket.
Okay.
Where you put bait in.
They swim into it.
Yeah, and they swim in. You just go collect them in the morning.
Sweet.
That'll be that part. The last part is the deep water survey.
Yeah, this is the exciting one.
So most of these, the giants, these 8-9 footers, so most of the survey we're going to be doing is not focused on that. I think that's where everybody went wrong, in my personal opinion.
Looking for the big adult guys.
Yes, and the giants are going to be the rarest part of the population of a rare species.
The most hidden. Because not only, one, they have to survive to get that big long enough, but they, if they're, if they've survived and got that big, they're going to be smart. Hiding. Yeah, they're going to be smart and they're going to be hidden.
So it's the rarest part of the rare population.
It's like, what's a good example?
So we look for the babies. We look for babies and juveniles. They're the easiest parts to find, right, of these populations.
Right.
So long as we have time, and you know, everything else goes good. This is the last thing kind of on the checklist.
Mm-hmm.
As the deep water surveys of these lakes that the giants were seen in, Jay has bought a deep water submersible ROV.
Mm-hmm.
It's rated for 500 feet of depth, 600-foot-long cable. It's actually the same one from Katie Elizabeth's Champ research.
That's right.
It's the one that's got the picture of Champ and everything like
that. It's got cryptid history already in it.
It found Champ, so it's going to find this guy too. So that's going to be that part. And if we record and film some part of what we think could either be a den or an actual salamander, which would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The water's crystal clear, so I wouldn't be surprised. Then we will move the diving team from the river up to there.
Yeah.
And start actually looking. But that's a whole different thing, diving from shallow to deep water, you know.
Oh, big time difference.
So I know Zach is and Christian are both scuba certified.
They can do it. I don't think I could survive.
No, you can't do it. Human, a guy, I think non-certified is 20 feet is the deepest they'll let you go.
Oh, they're just allowed?
Yeah.
Please, I've dove in.
I'm talking...
Dove way deeper.
Canister of oxygen and stuff. Like canister.
I've never done that before.
Like, I did it one time. I hit 21 feet, and I guess I have a problem with my inner ear. And he warned you that if you don't know you have one, you'll find out when you hit 21 feet.
Oh, yeah.
Your head feels like it's blowing up because you can't release the pressure.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the types of survey. Do you, as a person that doesn't come from this background, what questions would somebody have about these surveying techniques?
I'm trying to find flaw on them, but I mean, that's pretty thorough covering those bases like that. I know I'll be part of like looking for dens and things like that, probably marking dens. That's probably going to be my job, I would assume, for the, well, you know, the first couple days when we're actively searching for these things, or I'm hoping I'm not going to be sticking my hands in any holes or anything like that.
Everybody has a bet. You'll be the one to find it because you're one of the only people that's going that doesn't have a biological background.
Right. So beginner's luck.
Well, that's just how it happens.
Oh, that was my Mr. Miyagi impression. I'm the one catching the fly in the chopsticks.
There you go.
On the first, look, Mr. Miyagi, I did it. He throws his chopsticks down, beginner's luck, and walks away.
So, yeah, and we have, I'm going to go over the team here in a second. But yeah, so it is done as a biological survey. Three of the core members have all done endangered species surveys.
That's helpful.
Three of them have done hellbender research. Specifically right now, Zach is in school for Ambystoma salamanders. Getting his master's in that. And David has done hellbender research.
This is the number one salamander team ever being assembled.
And I'm trying to get the hellbender lady that breeds them right now to come with us.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm not convinced her yet, but I'm trying. So
we need more. You know who else we need to add to the list?
Huh, Jimmy? Is that what you're going to say?
Oh, that would be a great one to add. Yeah, if you want Jimmy to come on this list, maybe if to come on this trip, sorry, not on the list, so to join us. If we reach our goal for Kickstarter, there'll be a stretch goal. Fun Jimmy's.
You've already added so many stretch goals.
Fun Jimmy to come along.
So we will be just camping. Like, we're not paying for a hotel. Everybody knows, like, we're going to be in the wilderness the whole time.
All right.
A lot of this stuff's going to take place at night.
Good.
In the river and stuff like that.
Good.
With bear.
Good.
California doesn't have bear, but kind of has bear.
Well, don't worry. I got these mitts.
Even though it's on their flag, they're all dead.
These two, you see this right here and this right here? They're registered deadly weapons on the National Registry list.
So let's talk about the team a little bit. Zach Alley. He's an ichthyologist, graduated from Miami University with a bachelor's degree in zoology in 2015 and an MS in conservation biology from the University of Western Alabama in 2023.
So anyone out there
I'm reading this as he wrote it.
Here's his resume.
Well, this is on the Kickstarter. I'm just reading his thing he wrote for the Kickstarter. I've worked with aquatic organisms since 2012, spent a lot of my free time documenting aquatic biodiversity in publications, quality portrait photos of fish and other aquatic life, crayfish, herps, and et cetera. Most recently, researching focus on stemmatics and phylogenics, I can't speak today, and characterization life history traits of co-occurrence between Ethiostoma purpurina and Ambystoma salamanders in the Black Belt Prairie region of Alabama, Mississippi.
Okay. That's all of that is above my pay grade.
Fish and salamanders, co-occurrence of them.
Yeah, I'm just saying. He's very qualified for this.
And David Pounders, which is our herp guy. His name's David Pounders. He's a biologist. He was born in Panama City, Panama, but grew up in northwest Alabama ever since he was young. He has been obsessed with animals, mainly reptiles and amphibians, lived in Alabama, made it easy to get most of the biodiverse areas. It wasn't hard to find different, you know, snakes, critters, turtles, and scaly critters. I knew I wanted a career in wildlife conservation and work with reptiles and amphibians. My areas of expertise are ichthyology. Herpetology was the study of reptiles and amphibians. And population genetics. I'm currently working on a non-game species conservation concerns for molecular techniques to aid the understanding of these creatures. My main focus is on narrow and epidemic, as my understanding is genetic structures of a species is important to inform conservation managers. He'll be mostly doing our DNA collection, if you couldn't tell.
Nice.
I still consider myself a field biologist, even though I work in a lab. To this day, I lead an assistant field crew, though, doing surveys, population assessments, and habitat assessments. I one day plan to use my skills to enter the academic settings, though, to focus on entities to aid in conservation of aquatic species.
Nice. Okay. So,
yeah, right now he's doing a lot of conservation work, but he's worked with hellbenders, too.
So he's
and
a clean...
Christian...
He's a clean scientist that wants to be a dirty
scientist? He's still both.
Okay, fair enough.
Christian has been a professional wildlife documentarian, scuba diver expert, and professional treasure hunter. His is a lot shorter.
Yeah.
Because he let me write it for him.
That's awesome. We got a professional treasure hunter coming with us.
Yeah, he's been on like Oak Island, and he's found Spanish gold. He's one of the few, like, he was, remember he talking, like, you know, like four or five people in the U.S. history have ever found Spanish gold or something like that.
Yeah, he's one of them.
So that's kind of the crew.
That's the basic bones of the crew.
Now let's talk about the importance. I know this is going to be a long episode and it's just halfway begging you for money. But
a little bit. But you know what? It's not just us making this discovery happening. It's all of us.
No, this is the Cryptids of Corn family.
Yeah.
This is, you know.
You're all going to have your names on this once we discover this thing.
So, exactly. What was I saying? Oh, so why this is important. So, during, you know, even up into the 1990s, this species of salamander is probably safe from most human impact.
Okay.
For its region. So, the Sacramento River had several dead, as we read on here, and there's even more that we haven't read, dead giant salamanders that people just kept saying were giant Japanese salamanders.
Mm-hmm.
They just kept having dead ones, and they're just like, oh, they kept getting released here. They were probably native all the way through the Sacramento River up into the mountains.
Yep.
And then pollution and dams started killing these things off.
Mm-hmm.
And the Trans Alps was kind of their last strong suit. The problem is now, Hubbard Lake is gone, where the original giants were seen.
Yep.
They dammed it up and built a reservoir. Since then, sightings have been scattered only to the tips in the mountains. This giant cryptid is probably on the edge of extinction. Their habitat is being eaten up by the day for industry, recreation, and stuff like that. So the Save the Salamander t-shirt's not a joke.
No.
It is to save this salamander.
Yeah.
That they are so susceptible to any kind of change in their environment.
The canary in the coal mine.
They are. So this literally what was once a remote mountain range is now a tourism hotspot. The lake has everything from jet skiing, all kinds of stuff on it.
Yeah.
And every year they're just eating more and more and more of this wilderness
disgusting.
Area.
Disgusting.
And it's, I think if, so here's the thing with the California government I said I'd get back to. It's in this gray area, right, where the California government says this thing may exist, and if it ever gets proven to exist, it will immediately have endangered species protection. So the second either the DNA study comes out or we catch a 4-foot salamander, one or the other kind of deal, it could be both, you know, with the projects, we're trying to be there for a week or more to really work on this. So if we get one or the other, they will immediately receive all endangered species protection until California sends its own team out to confirm everything we found.
Right.
And we'll have a specimen. We'll either have the genetic study, which is being backed by, I can't name the lab, but is being backed by a big biology lab, and or the live specimen, which a live specimen, or in the genetic study, the type of genetics we're doing would be enough proof It's not a fakeable thing.
Right, right. But having that live.
It always helps.
Absolutely.
So they'll immediately stop any kind of construction in the Trinity's Alps area. So if you look at the map, like if you go through back in time, even the 80s, there's nothing there. You can't get there. It's hiking trails and like stone roads.
So hopefully some.
Now there is campgrounds,
right.
Recreation, dams. The New River, like we mentioned earlier, has a big dam on it to flood the valley. And just dams destroy everything, not just the salamander habitat. So this is really to save this salamander.
To save the salamander, save the whole area. And I hope it wrecks some billionaire's future, like multi-million dollar megaplex plans to take over this whole slice of nature and capitalize on it and make money off it. I hope it just wrecks someone's planet there named Bill.
So what do you think about that, though? Save the salamander. You're the one that was screaming it. You're the one that made it famous.
I think that's the most important part of all this. Saving the species, putting it in the books officially, making history. That's what it's all about, making history for the good, a good point in history to make. Not one of the bad history-making points.
I do think this is the cryptid most likely to be proven in the next 5 years, but I think it's also one of the cryptids that's most likely to extinct in the next 10.
Oh, absolutely.
I think they're right kind of teeter-tottering on that edge. I think some of the big adults are still hiding out in the mountains.
And that's being like positive about it, I think, you know.
I think right now, if we don't find them on this next expedition, I don't think they'll be around, you know, in the next decade or two.
Yeah, probably not. But this is the last, in my mind, this is the last hope to...
So other species have gone extinct just like this.
Basically...
Just with, you know, walking hand in hand with industry.
You know what I think of this is? This is the salamander sending us a message through the little Star Wars telegram thing where you know, it's Princess Leia, and she's like, help me, Obi-Wan.
A hologram?
Hologram, not telegram, hologram. You're my only hope.
Somebody make that t-shirt.
So, yeah, there's a salamander beaming into our studio right now.
Princess Leia.
Yeah, as Princess Leia salamander, help me, Cryptids of the Corn.
You're my only hope.
Save the salamanders, 2025. Cryptids of the Corn. Trinity's Alps giant salamander hunt.
So, yeah, we've tossed around some names if we do discover it. Depends on if it's a cryptobranchia or an Andreas.
Okay.
Andreas cornfelius. Is cool. One I thought of. Andreas Irwinus.
After Steve?
Yeah. That's one I've really thought about a lot. So we're actually getting a rock made that has, you know, a memorial to Steve to take out with us. Because this is definitely something that Steve has inspired, at least in me.
Yeah.
That this is a conservation of a species that that our kids won't get to enjoy if we don't do something about it.
Right.
The North American giant, probably the biggest living species of salamander on the planet. Probably hit those 8 or 9 foot.
Gotta find him.
We really do to save them.
Right.
It's not about finding a cryptid. No, we have stuff much closer to us.
Saving an animal.
It's saving something that will be wiped out very soon. But we're actually getting a rock made that has, you know, a memorial to Steve that we're going to put in the river with him.
That's cool.
That's going to take with us. And I think we may take a cardboard cutout of Steve to kind of for pictures and stuff like that. So he can just be in the background like Bigfoot.
He's just there. That'd be cool. I don't know. You almost might have to make it what Ambio Mr. EO.
It's not an ambiostoma.
No, whatever you were saying earlier.
You can't name it
Andreas,
yourself.
Andreas. Oh, well, I can name it Mr. E.
What? Andreas Mistronius?
Because you're the salamander guy. What would be better than having a salamander named after?
You're supposed to name it after somebody else, traditionally.
Well, okay, if I discover it, let's say I am the first one to pull it out of its hole, it's going to be called Mr. E.
So what have I told you? Do you have anything to add before we move on?
Or Andre the giant salamander.
What have I told you? So this seems weird, right? That why is there no fossil record of that? And mountain ranges often preserve fossils very poorly.
Right.
Salamanders do not fossilize well, especially the giants. You know, when we look back through history, the Jurassic, Miocene, and stuff like that, you really just see the big adults of those species. You don't find a lot of babies because they dissolve so fast. What have I told you? There is fossil evidence of a giant Andreas that lived there.
Oh. Was this in the last episode?
Maybe. I have no idea.
I don't know either.
2 years ago, two and a half years ago.
Yeah.
Andreas Matthewi. is a quote unquote extinct species that lived in the western Nebraska, Colorado, Saskatchewan, California, Oregon, and Washington.
Wow, it's kind of all in that area.
Yeah, so they never found their they never found their fossils in the mountains. But this is an extinct species of giant salamander from the Miocene of North America. It belongs to the genus Andreas, which contains, like we talked about,
right,
all the Asian giants and the hellbender. It is the largest salamander to have ever existed, a part of this family group, with maximum estimated length of 7 to 9 feet.
Wow, right in our range.
What did everybody say the giant or the Alps giant salamander?
6 to 10, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
This fossil has been found mostly in Nebraska, Colorado, and Saskatchewan, but they kind of estimate its range because the mountains itself don't fossilize. So we kind of get
the runoff
fossils on the edge.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about this guy a little bit, but yeah. So there is one that should be there, and it's been called Cryptobranchius matthewi or Andreas matthewi.
Okay.
So it kind of gets back and forth. They don't really know who it's related to more. So it's either related to the Asian giants or the North American giant.
Gotcha.
They're both closely related, though. Both
right. They're cousins.
Yeah. But it's just this guy is kind of in the middle, which sounds weird because there's an ocean in between them. But we're talking, you know, hellbenders 150 million years old.
Stretch back quite a while.
Yeah. So they were very close all at one point. All the giant salamanders were probably the same. All these guys were the same species at one point. And just, you know, continental drift moved them further away.
Right.
Not them, you know, traveling. They don't travel well.
Right.
You know, they don't leave their mountain range. Yes. So it was described by Harold Cook, a new genus. First, he put it in Pelagornis matthewi, and then, which is lower Snake Creek beds of Nebraska. The species was named after William Diller Matthew, who first identified the specimen. So Harold named it after the first guy who described the specimen later. But yeah. And then 1963, Joseph Tibet and Charles Chantel named a new species, Cryptobranchius massilii, for its two maxillae of the Valentine Formation in Nebraska. And Charles Mosey synthesized that these are both the same species, but they also belong to Andreas. So this is the thing with fossils is they get changed around a lot.
Yeah, because you don't know for sure.
Yeah, you should look how long ago I forgot to put it in here. I did this from the hospital room.
Yeah.
Everybody, I wrote the script from the hospital room, so apologize. I apologize for anything I have off a little bit in here. I didn't look up how long ago the Miocene was.
We look it up. Oh, yeah. Miocene?
Yeah, the Miocene. It's big mammals. It's like the Ice Age, I believe.
Gotcha.
Or right before the Ice Age. And then eventually, Bruce Nalen synthesized that they are all the same species. And then he combined it to Cryptobranchius matthewi. But that hasn't been fully accepted yet.
Miocene was 23 to 5.3 million years ago.
Yeah, so relatively, as far as fossils are concerned, relatively recently.
That would have been a cool time to live. I would have liked to live in that.
For a species that fossilized very poorly in a very poorly fossilized region.
What?
No, I'm saying that could be why there's no more fossils.
Oh, why this? Oh, yeah, of course.
Fossils are extremely rare where they're from.
In general, yeah, fossils are rare. So having an animal that dissolves in like a day after it's dead in water, it's going to be extremely rare. It has to just like fall in a mud bed or something, it covered in. Have nothing touch it, basically. I don't know how else it would. I have no idea. I'm shocked they found any.
And it was all big ones.
Right, so they actually had bones?
That wouldn't, like, basically salamanders dissolve really quick and they get pulled apart.
Right,
especially in the water.
So there's nothing for the fossil into.
And they don't stick, like, the bones don't stay around each other very long.
Right. And the only reason I know that or believe it is because that one time you had that salamander at the old studio.
That passed away. It was alive the morning. We left.
It passed away, and by that evening when we came back, it was gone.
Like, just like a jawbone and stuff.
It was, the rest was dissolved in this tiny tank. It had nothing else in it.
Not a tiny tank. I wasn't keeping it.
Well, tiny relative to a lake or a stream.
It was a single salamander, a 20-gallon tank.
Yeah. I mean, you know, relative to a lake, it's tiny, you know, but there was nothing in it. Nothing but the salamander. No little fish.
Had a bubble filter. Or had sponge filter, which doesn't suck.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not something actually eating it.
Yeah. I get you.
Yeah.
I still wanted to sound like I was torturing a salamander.
Oh, no, not like that. No, yeah, you had it in a one-by-one little... No, no, it was a decent-sized tank for the salamander all by himself.
Pretty much all my tanks were oversized.
He was a male specimen, I remember that.
Yeah, he was a boy. He wouldn't leave... Yeah, he wouldn't... Yeah, I was. But right when I was about done breeding axolotls.
I still remember, though, it's just gone. Like, hey, I think he escaped. You're like,
They don't do that.
Yeah, no, he passed away. He's just gone. Like, oh, okay.
I think it was just a puddle in the back corner.
There's almost literally nothing.
A jawbone in a puddle.
Yeah. Like it was, nothing to look for.
So that's kind of where we're at with this study. If you guys, I don't know. I mean, what else do you want to add?
I mean, we're traveling across the country to do this expedition. It means a lot to us. It's been a thought of yours since we started this episode back in season one. It's been a goal, then it just became an idea that's now slowly coming to fruition. We just, you know, if we get the funding to do it, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And if there's extra, you know, I'll skydive out of a plane into a lake to find it, or we'll bring Jimmy.
If there's extra, we're just going to stay longer.
Oh, yeah, that deal. Yeah.
Stay a whole month.
Oh, man. No, it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to find this thing. We're going to find it.
And like I said, I have more faith in that we'll find a juvenile or a baby. And
we're going to find evidence.
The DNA study will. The DNA study. So that's the thing I think is what's going to set this expedition apart.
Yep.
Not only is it the only DNA study ever done for these guys, it will be the most comprehensive one done on a cryptid that's not Bigfoot probably ever.
So that's saying something. That's history.
Because I know there's been some Bigfoot ones done, but everybody's heard my gripes with how people collect Bigfoot DNA.
Right.
Especially if you think Bigfoot's a primate or maybe even an ancient human.
Yeah,
you know?
Close to us, yeah.
This is a salamander. It's, you know, you still got to collect, like, you have to have gloves even with this stuff because you'll ruin the sample. You'll ruin an animal that's not related to you, you know, at all very closely.
By still touching it.
Yeah, by getting your sweat and stuff near it.
Yeah.
So collection, and I do want to say, it is, all the specimens going to go back alive for DNA collection.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Some people, I've been yelled at by organizations when I was doing this for a living.
Ah.
That, you know, we're killing animals to take DNA samples because we were taking hundreds or thousands of DNA samples.
Yeah.
No, so the thing with these salamanders, what we'll be collecting is a bit of their tail fin.
Okay.
It'll be a fin trimming, which will grow back.
Right.
They don't have any nerve endings in the edge of it.
It's not hurting it.
They eat each other's tails off all the time.
Yeah.
I mean,
the only thing we're doing to them is a minor inconvenience of their time.
Mm-hmm.
That's
it. Yeah. And we're going to take, if we get some specimens, we'll take them back and, you know, we'll try grow them out. That'd be awesome.
That'd be freaking sweet.
Everybody's like, no, that's just a Pacific giant salamander. Well, it's 4 foot long now.
Yeah. Wait till it's in the backyard.
Feeding it chickens.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I'm excited. I'm very excited.
All right. Well, once again, the link below is for the Kickstarter. Even if you can't support it financially, please share it. We greatly appreciate you guys. Help us find this thing. I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I have been the great and powerful Mystery.
And I've been Jay Clone 42.
We'll catch you next week, guys.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Cryptids of the Corn Podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the J clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on cryptidsofthecorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye!
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.